Welcome to the Ian Bousfield Experience. I'm glad you're here. This series of podcasts are just things that come up in my mind when I'm thinking about playing, when I'm thinking about teaching, and general thoughts about music. There are some things here that I hope you'll find really useful. And don't forget, if you've got any comments or if there's anything you want to discuss further, go to ianbousfield.com. Hello from an extremely cold, windy, blustery, on Spring Lake, Switzerland. Nothing to be jealous of here. It's been so cold. Very unusual weather. Anyway, hello. I haven't spoken to you for a while, have I? I've been off social media. I did it without making the big announcement of just to let you know I will be leaving Facebook forever. Goodbye, cruel social media. I just woke up one morning and thought, nah, I can't be bothered. And I have to say, so far, my life's the better for it. I haven't seen any Rex Martin cycling photos, so he has to send me those privately now. But I don't know, it's been about a month, I think, since I've looked, and I can't believe I used to spend so much time looking at it. Anyway, the competition. The reason why I'm doing this podcast now is I've finished my marking in the final round and I've sent it off. I have made my decisions, I have made my choices. And many of you will be aware who's followed this process along from the beginning that it was partly, we did this really to try and give all of the young trombone players out there who unfortunately have been, for want of a better word, in the slammer for the last 14 months who have been locked away, not allowed to perform, to try and give them a bit of an opportunity to perform, to show what they can do before things get opened up again, you know, get them a bit of preparation. So I'm absolutely delighted that we did this. But I realized it came with a responsibility, and I've been a big critic of competitions in the past. So rather than just standing on the sidelines and saying what I didn't like about this competition or this competition, I did try to do my own so that everyone else could stand on the sidelines and say they didn't like mine. what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I believe. So what I wanted to do was, if you remember, the trombone players that young players aspire to be have always traditionally been a combination, not always, but 99%, a combination of an orchestral player who plays solos. We're not on one of those instruments where, you know, you win the Tchaikovsky piano competition and you just play concertos for the rest of your life. Unfortunately, we have, you know, we don't play on one of those blessed instruments. So the idea was to play like an orchestral first round, if you like, you know, the first movement of the David Concerto and then the Mozart Requiem. And then to be free, let your hair down, do what you want, shows what you can do. So it's the two sides of it. It's the orchestral side where people show they can earn money, playing, you know, in a day job, as it were. And then to be a creative artist. And I was really happy with that format. I've always wondered why more competitions on our instrument have not been done that way. And the other thing that was very important to me was not just being fair, but the appearance of fairness, the perception of fairness to all who observe. I think having, you know, people judging their own students and that sort of thing is not good. And initially, I wasn't even going to judge the first round, but we got so many entrants, 144 or something for the first round, that I picked out these a really good select group of friends, colleagues, really the best, to judge it by. They would very shortly thereafter not be my friend if I asked them to listen to the David and the Mozart Requiem 144 times. So we realized very quickly we needed another format. So what we did was we took more judges on. We brought, some really cool people in. One of them, of course, is a very unknown person called Christian Griego, who I pushed to the front and said, you have to do it. Because that guy, Christian Griego, has listened to everybody for the last 25 years. He's been my confidant and formerly with Joe, and he knows exactly what we can do, what we can't do, what we're worried about, what we, you know. And he's also followed, as I've said before, he's followed young players from the age of 15 or 16 through into major orchestra jobs. So he knows what it takes. So he went on there, Nir Erez from the Israel Philharmonic. It's great. We've got a great list. You can look at them online. It's all there. And I got roped into it. I wasn't initially going to listen to the first round, but I did. Now, what we did, and I even, it's a learning process. And what I learned is that Edwards have got this amazing person called Lexi. Some of you might get emails from her if you haven't paid your bill. And she may be your first point of contact there. And she's picked this up and run it like it's her own thing. And she's done an unbelievable job. And I'll tell you why. You know, I know you're supposed to traditionally say that and thank the people who've organized and all that stuff, but this is amazing. I met her several times, but I never realized she was so amazingly efficient. As Kristen Griego says, you know, when you ask her to do something, you have to really be sure that you know that that's what you want to happen, because if you have second thoughts, it's too late. She's already done it. And what we did was we divided the judges up into three groups of three. And I'll be honest, I decided which judges were going to be in which group. I've forgotten. So I don't even know who was. I think Kristen was in my group, but I don't know who the other person was. Sorry, there you go. An insight into the organized brain of Ian Bousfield. So, but actually it turned out to be, I don't know how the other groups were organized now. I forgot we did it a couple of months ago. And Lexi took the video away from all of the first round, and you made a declaration as to who studies with you. And so she could sort of curate it. So you didn't even get to hear someone who you teach. You know, it's like you're judging a completely different competition to the one that they're in. It's fantastic. Worked really, really well. And so I'm really delighted with the format, the way that worked in the first round. And we submitted our points. We did it out of 100. We submitted the points to her. And here's the really cool thing. This is my competition. It's got my bloody name on it. I have no idea who was winning after the first round. I don't know. It was all done totally, utterly, anonymously. So no names. We don't know who the people were in the first round. We gave points. And I have no idea who I put through from the first round when I see them in the second round. It's all completely, it's even more anonymous than a normal orchestral audition. So really, really cool. So I'm just so happy at the, you know, not just the fairness of it, but the perception of the fairness. I don't think we could have done any more in that regard. It's absolutely incredible. So we cut it down to 30 or 33, I can't remember, in the second round. And there we got the video. So those of you who are listening, no, I'm not telling anyone who was in the final. That we didn't do. And we got to look at it. And I did take the liberty of having a quick listen. It was what I think has been very interesting, what I suspect has happened, is that there are a few, in inverted commas, soloists who didn't make it through the first round because they didn't do the kind of dressage element of it. And there are a few people who got to the final who perhaps need to work a little bit on their solo skills. And so the winners of the competition, who I have absolutely no idea who they are, I don't think, I think I'm one of the first judges to have finished. So I have no idea what the results are, but I think, you know, the winners of this competition are really going to have proved themselves to have being able to stand up in both fields. You can't really have a weak one. So I'm absolutely delighted with it. That's where we are. Watch this space, folks. The results will be out. I'm not sure when. There we go. You see, look at this. He's got my name on it. It's my competition. I don't know what's going on. Isn't this fantastic? Isn't this the way it should be done? Isn't this incredible? Anyway, so that's where we are. My feeling right now is that the format really, really works. And I'm really, really happy that we did it this way. And I'm as excited as you are to find out who's won it. I recently suggested to one of my students that he should work on some Arthur Pryor. He was having a bit of trouble with his articulation. And I said, well, look, nobody I know who plays Arthur Pryor really well has a problem with articulation. Let's just do that so you don't have to practice. It's not boring then. You don't have to just practice Arban etudes the whole time. And he said, yeah, but Ian, Arthur Pryor's a lot of rubbish, isn't it? It's not really proper music. And so I took a very deep breath, as you can imagine, and said, well, what makes you say that? You know, and this is someone who plays Xenarchus extremely well. I said, yeah, but it's not really proper music, is it? And I said, well, I mean, my answer was really simple. Well, first of all, show me you can play it, and then you never have to do it again. And so just come back next week playing some Arthur Pryor. And as it happens, the guy turned back as the reincarnation, turned up the next week as the reincarnation of Bob Iserly. It was extraordinary what he did. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. He did such an amazing job at it. Wonderful player, really expressive musician. And I wondered why there seems to be, particularly in Europe, a sort of like a movement very much to playing proper music, new music, you know, Xenarchus, Berio, wonderful, great stuff. I always choose those two as an example, don't I? Great, great music, fantastic. And it made me realize, and this is also going back onto a little bit of a topic that I've seen floating around on social media about what should be taught in universities. And when I was a kid back in 1853 or whenever it was, when I was studying, you know, the first trombone player played on a Con 8H or a Bach 42 with a size 6.5 mouthpiece, second played on a, you know, a trombone with a valve, you know, and played on a Bach 5G. The bass trombone player played on a Con, what do you call them, 72, 74, what are they? You know, those things with a Bach 2G mouthpiece, you know. And the first trombone player played high. Didn't matter if you couldn't play low. Second trombone player had a good middle register. Didn't matter if you couldn't play high. You know, bass trombone was like a tenor trombone who could play low. And then that naughty boy, Christian Lindbergh, turned up and changed the range of the trombone from the bottom of the contrabass trombone up to the top of the alto trombone. And the reason why I say he's a naughty boy is because he kind of like had all these pieces commissioned like that and then walked off and left us to it and became a conductor. That's why he's a naughty boy, because he's left us now with the problem. You know, I remember the stresses and the demands that were placed on my embouchure, because I kind of grew up with this, well, it doesn't matter, you're going to play first trombone, it doesn't matter about your low register too much, you know, and I had one of these natural sort of trumpety high registers. And it's like, you know, my only fear was, you know, my only hope was that Mahler 3 never came up on the orchestra schedule too early in my career. Because it wasn't a pretty sight, as one might imagine. It was a bit of a, it was a rather hot. My sound was rather hot, shall I say. It went beyond bright. The colour was definitely on the bright side of the spectrum. So anyway, but, you know, the dirdons and things like that, I just didn't have play them for fun. It was really easy. And I was very lucky, actually. When I went to the London Symphony, I missed Mahler 3 No, in the Halle Orchestra, I missed Mahler 3 by a week. No, it wasn't Mike Hext. It was Mike Hext. Played Mahler 3, I think, the week before I started. A week or 2 weeks. And in the London Symphony, they'd just done it 6 months earlier. It didn't come up for a few years after I joined. When I went to Vienna, bang, it was straight up, but I was already up and ready for that sort of thing. But anyway, that's just a kind of a background of what we needed to know. You could play something really adventurous, like the Tomasi, huh? You know, but now the trombone repertoire has just completely exploded. Arthur Pryor was like, that was the exotic solo piece on your final recital for a student. Someone might play the Bluebells of Scotland. Wow. And wow, what a change. What a change. And, you know, our repertoire is all the richer for it. But the point I'm making is that the learning process, the education process for a student, they have to be able to do far more things. I mean, we just used to spend the first 2 years of study, you know, making sure that a student made a good sound and articulation, good legato, good slide technique. And things, they have to sort of hit the ground running much more these days. And I think that's to the detriment of basic technique, which is what leads me into Arthur Pryor. Not necessarily as basic technique as you might think of it, but as to basic performance technique. When I was a kid, I used to play solos in what they called working men's clubs. And it would be where working men would go on a Saturday night and drink too much beer. And they'd have an act on. They'd have a comedian, you know, they'd have an Elvis Presley impersonator. Horrible places they were. Floors were sticky because the beer had kind of like dried onto the floor. And on a Saturday night, the working man would take his wife there, who would put her best dress on and whatever. And he'd probably bring the grandmas, and it was like the family night. And as part of the entertainment, they'd usually have a kid up on the stage doing something, you know, like a Judy Garland sort of impersonation or whatever. And because I came from the north of England, it was very often a brass player. Because in the north of England back then, you either play cricket or a brass instrument. In my case, both. That was like what you did. And so I'd stand up when I was 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever and play Bless This House or the Lost Chord, who knows, The Holy City. And I realised that if I played in a certain way, the grandmothers used to give me more money after I'd finished. Oh, come here, love. Oh, yeah, you're lovely, yeah, you know. And then they'd reach into the purse and a coin had come out. And I thought this was great, it's fantastic. I used to, so Saturday night, Sunday morning, I'd get up and do my paper round and then go and spend what I'd earned on chocolate, because I come from a chocolate city. I come from York, home of Kit Kat before the Swiss bought it and closed the factory down. After 8 Mints, Yorkie bars, what else was it? Was it chocolate oranges, all that sort of stuff. So I used to wake up every morning smelling chocolate. We ate chocolate. Funny, I finished up living in a country that is probably one of the world's most famous, if not the most famous chocolate company. Anyway, I digress. So the more that you would play things, you know, in a certain way, really reaching out to the audience and really exaggerating the emotion and the expression, you know, the more they'd like you and they'd get you back and they'd give you coins. which reminds me, I go off theme again, of Rostropovich, one of the greatest musicians ever to have walked this earth, said that he really learnt his communication, or the extent of the communication. He harboured Solzhenitsyn in his attic, which is not a very good thing. He was a dissident. The Russian authorities didn't like that very much. But it was Rostropovich, so you couldn't just sort of like send him permanently to Siberia. So they only temporarily sent him to Siberia on a tour, and a very long tour as a punishment. And he went from village to village playing the cello. He had to go around with his cello from village to village in Siberia to whaling communities who'd never heard a cello before in their life. And he had to go to concert, they'd all come in. And he said, you know, there'd be these guys dressed in bearskins, literally. He'd be freezing in there, dressed in bearskins. And he'd start playing a Bach cello suite. And they'd all start pointing and laughing and thinking it was absolutely hilarious. And he said, the more they laughed at him, the louder he played. And then they laughed more, and he played louder and louder. And he got, until he realized that if he played really quietly, all of a sudden the attention went on. And he said he really honed his abilities to draw people in. And I saw that, you know, goodness knows, 30 years later, you know, I saw him do that very same trick that he learned there in corporate sponsors concerts at the London Symphony Orchestra at the end of the Dvorak Cello Concerto, where you could see people who'd already had half a bottle of champagne and were only there because their boss said they should be there, absolutely with their mouths open, not the same thing, just gawping, as we'd say where I come from, gawping at them, just not believing what's happening. And I think all of this überspringen, jumping over stages of our development, is something we need to be aware of at the moment. Standing up on a working men's club, learning how to make old ladies cry, which is what I did when I was a kid, is a stage in our development as musicians. That's where we came from, and it may well be where we're going to. If you hear any rattling around, that's the wind. It's very windy today. And that leads me onto the subject of Arthur Pryor. Arthur Pryor's a load of rubbish, though, isn't it? As I was told. And it's like, was it Einstein? There's a lot of quotes attributed to Einstein are probably not his. But along the lines of, one of the most gratifying things you can ever do is take a log and an axe and bring the axe down on the log and split it, because you've immediately achieved what you set out to achieve. And there's an element to being able to play Arthur Pryor that's a similar sort of thing. It's like, I've got all these books behind me here. Actually, I don't think I've still got these on the bookshelf there. But they used to get these books called like French for Dummies, Maths for Dummies, Computers for Dummies. Yeah, I had a few of those. Didn't help me much. I didn't qualify to be a dummy, I'm afraid. And Arthur Pryor, now forgive me, Arthur Pryor lovers, as I am, I'm one of you. It's a little bit like Communication for Dummies. You can't play Arthur Pryor if you're not communicating. You can't. It's like a music hall act. Listen to Arthur Pryor, folks. Listen to the way he used to do it. He was doing the equivalent of what I was doing in a working men's club. And the more, it's such an easy entry into being able to communicate. The same as playing hymn tunes, or like when I was a kid, you know, you play the hymn tune. Here are the words to the hymn tune. And actually, I must remind myself to go back to that later. It's another subject to talk about. You know, to the, you know, hymn tune, understand the words of the hymn tune and then show the emotion of those words. Arthur Pryor, you can call it a circus act, you can call it bad music or whatever, but you've got to be able to do it. It's the stage in our development, our evolution as musicians that we need to go through. And the same as standing up in church, as I did, and playing a solo when I was seven, you know, the lost chord or whatever. And it's the same, it's exactly the same thing. So we mustn't jump past and say, yes, 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 that was, but now is. No, now is because of that, the ability to perform and to sell and to communicate with Xenarchus. You can learn, hone, and develop by being able to authentically, correctly play Arthur Pryor. Same with the David. You know, you want to learn how to break somebody's heart. You've got to learn how to break somebody's heart. Hang on a minute. I actually have to stop here. I'll explain why in a minute. Yeah, I told you it was windy. I put some wine boxes, not wooden ones, outside for the recycling. And they'd been blown halfway up the street. One of my neighbours brought them back for me. I told you it was windy. Anyway, back onto subject. So you can learn how to play a heartbreaking melody like that by doing the simplest of tasks, to go back to the Einstein thing about chopping wood. So yes, it is important to go through those phases, and it's not, you know, we all have to first be able to do it, and then you can say it's not very good. Anyway, I was reminded of something else. I was working with one of my students yesterday, who's playing a song cycle by a Danish composer. Trombone players all tend to play, you know, they're like playing Mahler songs, Brahms songs, regrettably sometimes. And so it's, and I've sat in exams where a criticism has been made of a trombone player because they're not playing the articulation of the words. Come on, seriously? Now, before we go any further, if you take something like Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen by Mahler, the words are so intrinsically linked with the kind of automatic articulation. And I'm not talking about the phrasing here, folks. I'm talking, of course, we play the phrasing according to, you know, to the words, to the text. But the actual articulation, that you would articulate two notes differently depending on the, whether it's a consonant or a vowel or, yeah. See, the problem is, this song cycle, you see, was in Danish. So first of all, there's two problems here. One is, the only person on the stage who can see and understand the words is the soloist. The people in the audience don't know what the words are. And if they did know what the words were, they wouldn't understand them. That goes mostly for, you know, people who play Brahms, Schubert, Mahler songs. Come on, face it, folks. You don't know what those words mean, do you? And when there is an English translation, the English translation tends to be horrible, I have to say. I was at the Royal Academy of Music recently, and I was talking to a vocal coach about, you know, I said, Die Tote Stadt, Eric Korngold. You know, the English words, the English translation, they're no relation whatsoever to the German, in my opinion. You know, and he said, well, why don't you go and talk to that guy over there? He did it. This little old guy in a corner. Anyway, I digress again. I tend to, don't I? It's what I do. And I've been in an exam, you know, it's like, oh, he didn't play the articulation of the words. It's like, okay, that's like something just to please academics, just to get them happy. Now, remember, I said, yes, the words, the text will show us the phrasing. Yes. Our job as a trombonist, we don't have words. We can't say words through the trombone like someone singing. So our task with these songs is something quite different. There are two things. First of all, when I've approached doing these, you have to set your tongue free. Ta, da, do, to. All go out of the window. In order to successfully play vocal repertoire on the trombone, you cannot use basic trombone technique. You cannot use the standard way of articulating. It's got to be, as the French would say, a feeling. It's got to be relating to the, you know, the emotion that you want to put out there. Set your imagination free, and with it your tongue. the articulation system. The second thing is you absolutely have to understand the words, the text. You have to understand the emotion and the meaning of the text. And that is what you have to put into the music. So the listener picks up the emotion of the words. We can't say the words. So just by articulating the same way the words are written, how on earth do you expect the audience to understand what you're doing? I was going to click goodbye then, but that's my feelings on that. And I would just like to say, it's been nice talking to you. I haven't done one of these for a long time. I guess partly I've been so, I don't want to say negative, but just I've had enough of this situation. I want things to move on. I'm a musician. I want to play. I'm not playing. I'm getting really jealous now because some orchestras are starting to do things again. I'm not doing anything. I'm not doing any playing. And, you know, it's, I guess everyone says, oh, well, we've all suffered over the last year, you know. I think particularly as musicians, we've felt it more acutely. And it's like, you know, I've lost my family and my friends. I'm away from home normally 6 months of the year. And my family are in the United Kingdom and they're in America. I haven't seen them for 14 months, none of them. And my friends are in Scandinavia. They're in Austria. They're in Spain. They're in America. They're in Japan. And I've now been cut off from all of that. I've been cut off from what I do, who I am. And I've been cut off from my friends. So I've actually reduced in and I've just focused on the cool things, on my family and sitting in silence and reading books and not worrying about the world out there because there's nothing I can do about it. And I found it very therapeutic. I've really, really enjoyed it. I mean, really, what's going to be is going to be in this world at the moment, and we are just passengers. So anyway, that's how I'd like to end it. That's why I haven't spoken to you for a while. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Maybe I won't leave it as long next time. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. If there are any issues that you found particularly interesting, don't forget to contact me and always go to ianbousfield.com for lots more interesting stuff.